You know, I was reading some criticism from a Bay Area poet and critic who says that years ago there were poets who the average person had heard of, contemporary poets, living poets. Mm-hmm. For example, Ogden Nash, or like you said in our first segment, Carl Sandburg. That's not really the case today. It's by and large become an elitist game for the most part. And that's his argument, perhaps paraphrased and twisted around and shortened. But do you agree with the notion that poetry has become elitist and detached from working folks?
Yes, I do. I think that, I'm very distressed by the fact that the public has lost touch with poetry. I think to some extent it is a matter of poetry being a difficult medium. Obviously, television is much more attractive to a lot of people because it's easy. It's a more passive form of entertainment. You don't need to bring as much of yourself to a television show or a video as you do to something like poetry. Poetry is challenging. It makes demands on people, and not everybody is willing to assimilate those demands and make that kind of commitment. A lot of poetry in the early part of the century has gotten, admittedly, bizarre, strange. It makes statements that, to the average person who is used to things making sense in a clear, obvious kind of way, there's a tendency to feel diminished, to feel lost and confused, and that can't be very pleasant to people. So part of the problem might be education. If there was a better way to somehow educate and introduce people to poetry, that might help close the gap. But I'm very distressed by that. I would like to see more people enjoy poetry.
And yet with the slam going on and so many poetry readings going on, there seems to be a renaissance of poetry. Is there maybe that elitism, basically the academic sense of poetry? And if that's dying, more power to it. Maybe I should get my knife and join on the pile.
Well, I think you touched on something else that's going on in the poetry world, which is it's incredibly fragmented, just like the music world is fragmented. I mean, you have your heavy metal people, and you have your hip-hop people, and you have your rockabilly people. It's the same thing in the poetry world. A lot of the people that might be inclined to read somebody like, Leslie Scalapino, or Charles Bernstein, or John Ashbery, somebody whose influence is coming from linguistic theory. Those people might, that's not going to be everybody's cup of tea. They might prefer to go to a slam, which is much more performance-oriented. It's almost a form of stand-up comedy in a way.
Bad stand-up comedy quite often.
Sometimes, yes, yeah. Although I admittedly haven't been to that many slams myself, and so I'm hesitant to
judge it. Yeah,
yeah, I don't want to.
Good for you.
But there's a very big. I know a lot of people that might go to one of the subtext readings in Seattle, which is a pretty challenging. Most of the work that's presented there is pretty challenging stuff. It tends to be elliptical. Certainly different, maybe not elliptical, but definitely different than what you would encounter at a slam. Yeah.
Well, let's look at the criticism aspect for a moment. You do write criticism, and the Puget Sound region seems really kind of too polite for proper criticism, and yet it's that interplay that quite often strengthens a literary scene, where we can have that back and forth and that critical aspect. Diane DePriem was talking about the Floating Bear back in the early 60s at Mimeograph Press, and how there was criticism in that, but it helped strengthen. It really added power to the local scene. Don't seem to have that here in the Northwest. Do you find that to be true?
Yes, but that's partly because of the fact that poetry has lost so much of the audience that newspapers are not inclined to, or the more mainstream publications are not inclined to publish reviews. That's a big part of the problem right there. So that a lot of the criticism gets published in some of the more obscure journals that not everybody reads. There's a tremendous, tremendous amount of literary theory that's published, but that appears in the more obscure scholarly journals. Certainly not in the newspapers or the weeklies.
The Association of Writing Professionals Journal, stuff like that.
Yeah.
Well, if someone's just moving to the Northwest, it's very important that they know one thing for sure, that clothes are very important. not just flannel, not just flannel for grunge fashion, but also for survival. And you have a piece that is actually quite a good guide regarding clothes in the Northwest.
I have, Getting Dressed in the Great Northwest.
Yeah, would you care to share that with us?
Oh, sure. Yeah.
That's also in Eggs and Mirrors, Woodworks Press. So you can,
I hope it is, as I go looking around in here.
It's just a delightful sort of primer because, you know, the population around here is expected to double between now and 2020. So if anyone hears this on the internet or something and wants to move here, that should be very aware that clothes are very important. Does it sound like I'm rambling here?
Oh, here we go. I found it. Actually, you know, getting dressing for the Northwest is a challenge because the weather here is so erratic. You can have, 35, 40 degrees in a high humidity 1 minute, and the next thing you know, the clouds part and the sunbeams come splashing down to the ground, and the next thing you know, you've got trickles of sweat going down.
I thought you were going to say 35 to 40 layers is what you need to get by.
40, sometimes you do. So you have to be very inventive when it comes to getting dressed. Here's the poem. Getting dressed in the Great Northwest. I live in a wet northern climate. It rains a great deal. Clothing is important. A good warm coat of shelter cloth with action back sleeves and water-repellent pants with flat back pockets and a button fly is a real asset. Putting on a good coat is like becoming Yaphet Kotto as he appeared in Alien, a down-to-earth practical man, a pragmatic man, a confident man, a man who has seen it all man, a man who will face the devil for the right kind of money man. So much for the coat. But what about pants? What about length? What about waist? What about zippers and cuffs and crotchets and taste? Pants are not a problem. Pants abound at the thrift stores. They hang legless and limp, hapless and hollow in all sizes and walks of life. Party-colored and checked, paradigmatic and plaid, denim and corduroy, wrinkled and creased, capricious and stiff, stranded and clumped, just like real people. Pants are easy. But let me tell you about shoes. Shoes are crucial. Whether we shuffle or slide, creep or glide, shove or shrivel or shimmy or shake, shoes are crucial. Pants are a way to be in this world, but shoes are a way to be on this world. Legs are logical. One before the other, left, right, left, right, left, right, and so on, until we reach our destiny or domicile or dress rehearsal. But feet are fussy, fussy and fickle and flighty and frail, discriminating, touchy. Feet are hard to please. Look to it, friend. One should choose shoes shrewdly. A dry, finished tin cloth shirt is just the ticket for those really nasty days when the air takes a bite out of your skin and the ghost of your murdered father appears at the parapet urging revenge. And as for those deep winter nights when the wind comes howling out of the moon like a dragon of sleet and snow, I have but two words. Black underwear. New Zealand lambswool and a heavy rib knit with a button placket front and an elastic waistband will keep you cozy as a titmouse in hassock grass. Socks, of course, go without saying. Without a sock, a shoe feels cold as a mortgage. Now for the hat. Many people scoff at the idea of a hat. You can go without one, yes, but remember, the head is a cloud, a hot and delicate exuberance of hair, and requires protection. Heat escapes from the head like steam from a kettle. To step into a Northwest January without a hat is to embark on a wobbling course between the Scylla of Rheum and the Charybdis of Grip. What you need is wool. The wool hat is a domain of orchids and angels. It is expedient and warm. It is humble and true. Wool is wily and washable and wise. Wool is proleptic. It answers the cold before the wind has put it forward. One cannot overesteem the magic of wool. But, you say, you are different. You do not like wool. You say you are allergic to wool. What you need is the ultimate crusher. 10 sweet ounces of cotton duck, mildew and rain-resistant, with small grommets in the crown for ventilation and a foam insert to ensure flotation. We are almost ready, almost there. What is needed now is a little ornamentation, some tincture, some local color. ponder, if you will, this little fable. After the great flood, Raven was gorging himself on edibles on the beach. Hearing some strange sounds, he found a giant clamshell with little beings wiggling inside. He crooned and coaxed them out, and they were the first humans. Imagine this scene on a buckle of sterling silver, keeping those prophylactic pants up. Yes? Good. Now you are ready. Now you are dressed.
John Olson is our guest, Seattle poet and author of Eggs and Mirrors from Woodworks Press, and that's where that piece comes from. I'm Paul Nelson. We can just hear your joy with the language come through with everything you do. And you actually once did an interview, a brief interview, with the English language.
Yes, I did.
And in fact, I think what we did was make copies of this here.
Great.
So
okay.
I tell you what, you were the interviewer in the first place, but...
Do you want to be the straight guy? I'll be the straight man,
because I've had 38 years of practice. Okay, so it's a brief interview with the English language, with Paul Nelson playing John Olson and John Olson playing the English language. So we go from there. So, English, dear English language, when were you born?
I was born in an Anglo-Saxon inn somewhere near Hastings in 1066. Actually, it was more of a sudden mutation than a birth. Up until then, I sounded very Germanic, like hammers of ice pounding the mountains of the Black Forest. Then a Frenchman forced his way into our conversation and infected everybody's speech with armoires and dandelions.
How do you feel about polysemy?
I love polysemy. I wallow in polysemy. Polysemy is the Polynesia of speech. Polysemy is the ether of either and the amber of ambiguity. Polysemy is the pollen of polyphony and the proof of incertitude.
Do you have any thoughts about Noam Chomsky?
Noam Chomsky is the hoarse whisperer of syntax.
What exactly is a sentence?
A sentence is a sentence is a sentence. You know, huh? A sentence is a proclamation or a bunch of punctuation dancing around a predication. It all depends on predication and a verb. The verb is the engine of the sentence. You can predicate nothing without a predicate. Without a verb, all you have are shapes, vague shapes, shadows in the wings waiting to come on stage and do something, perform something, insist on something.
Are you rich?
Very.
Are there any sensations too fugitive to communicate?
Millions.
Will you ever change?
I'm changing all the time.
How do you feel about other languages?
I am other languages. I incorporate them into my being, like the blob. Remember the blob? It was a gigantic ball of protoplasm. Quite impressive, actually. Steve McQueen positively gawked at it. But that's another story. Here's what I do. I sidle up to another language and just ingest a few of its words into my system, and in no time at all, they're circulating round and round with all the other corpuscular words. It's as easy as eating a hamburger.
Do you ever make words?
Are you kidding? I make words all the time. That's what being a language is all about, kiddo. The instant you stop making words, the jig is up. You're a dead language, like Latin. Remember Latin? There are spatterings of Latin all over me. It's a bit creepy.
How do you go about doing it? Do you use cement, nails, glue, a system?
A system? Sure, you bet. The secret is in association, in connectedness. Every word is a generalization over life's commerce with experience. Words are like money, like coins. Each time there is an experience, say you feel cold or want to sit at the table or fall out of a boat, I turn a current of air into a coin of meaning, and there you have it. A nickel or dime at the tip of your tongue, ready to enter the commerce of exchange. The really cool thing is that every opportunity for putting words together is an opportunity for saying something that has never been said before. Every sentence is a realization of new associations.
You mean?
I mean like dusty tattoos stitched to a sheen of investigation, big Alaska nipples spurting recommendation and ladders, bladder caboose, theater fuzz, colossal maraca sleeves.
Uh-huh, interesting.
Just interesting?
Well, I'm not exactly sure. What exactly is a bladder caboose?
It's just an example of something that hasn't existed before.
Great. That's terrific. Thanks for your time. I've enjoyed our discussion.
Sure thing.
Now, let's talk about the editing process. One thing we haven't covered. Do you go back? Do you erase? I mean, is there big pilings of eraser dust on the sides of your table when you're done, or how does it work?
I like to shift things around. I like to, if one line doesn't work, I'll try another line. On balance, revision is not a joy with me. Some people enjoy revision. I was just, the poet Kathleen Fraser was in town recently, and she was talking about the joy of revision, and I don't enjoy revision. Once the inspiration is gone, the initial momentum that brought you to the language in the poem in the first place, once that dissipates, it's real hard to become analytical and try to make it better. Although, admittedly, revision does work. Things will become better when you go back.
Better in what sense?
Better in more clarity, fewer superfluous words that drain the energy of the overall work, things that don't need to be there.
But aren't we talking about better in a left brain, and better in a linear sense, better in a sense of the kind of writing that really we're getting away from? I mean, look at the Beats with all their spontaneous writing. Diane De Prima, you know, maybe changes a comma or a dash here, but for the most part, the way they throw it out there the first time is the way it stays, and they've had quite a lot of success with their work.
Yeah, that's a huge inspiration for me. The Beats, Ginsberg's maxim, first thought, best thought, actually does work in many instances. Unfortunately, it doesn't always work, and that's the problem, particularly if you start to gravitate more toward a more conceptually oriented work like Wallace Stevens, for instance, where it's a more cerebral kind of product than a lot of the language coming out of the Beat School, where there is a much higher premium placed on rawness and immediacy, on the genuineness of the feeling put out.
Huh. Besides writing, you like to cook as well. In fact, pizza, I guess, is one of your favorites.
Well, actually, I'm not sure about Roberta is actually
she's the
chef of our family.
I see. So
I do the dishes.
Where the pizza tray comes in.
That's where the pizza tray comes
you
in.
You have to clean it.
Yes, yeah. I have to scour it, and it's actually, once that pizza is baked there, it's tough getting the remnants off of the tray, and keeping that tray in pristine form is an impossibility.
It is ugly, isn't it?
It is ugly.
You know, there's another piece of, you know, I don't know if we're gonna have time for that and some of the other questions I have. We've got about 4 or 5 minutes left here.
Uh-oh.
It's hard to kind of throw that one out then just deny people the chance to hear that. Maybe a segment from that. Would that be possible?
A segment. First of all, I'd have to find this silly thing here.
And I can, in the meantime.
Oh, here we are. You got it right here. Okay. Maybe just the first couple of lines. Propped against the drain board between a bottle of dishwashing soap and an empty grape juice bottle, a pizza tray is a sheet of blackened carbon. It is a black rectangle. It is ugly, 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 ugly. It is ugly. I think that makes it fairly good.
I think we get the picture from that. Okay. But you really go into detail with it, and I guess that's something they can get from the book Eggs and Mirrors. The class on the prose poem, will you be covering the theory behind it,
oh,
the history
yes,
of it?
Definitely. Lots
Why don't you
of
give
theory.
Us a taste of that?
One of the writers I want to emphasize is Francis Ponge, a French writer who focused on the object. He has an entire book about soap, for instance. He has written about packing crates. He has written about oranges. He has written about the way trees appear in the fog in late autumn. His approach to the world is empirical, extremely empirical. And consequently, he makes a wonderful example for that approach to writing, where you become very focused on something common, something that you encounter every day, something that is very familiar to you. It makes writing a much more tangible enterprise when you have an object like that to focus on. But that's just the very beginning. There are quite a number of other experiences that I'd like to get into, like film, for instance, cinema, experimental film, and experimentations with narrative.
What makes it poetry if it's prose poetry?
The concentration on the effects of language, and attention, an attention that's brought to language that we normally don't bring to language when we're writing something for pure instruction, explaining how something is put together. There's a much greater margin for play, for linguistic play, for having fun, for exploring all the resources that are inherent in the language. So on balance, a writerliness.
It's obvious that this is your gift. There's no question about it. And yet you, like many artists, struggle at making a living doing what you do best. Why do we make things so hard for artists, and especially writers in our society?
I don't know. It's a very funny thing, because I've been talking about that. I'm always talking about that. Some writers actually do make quite a good living at it. Novelists such like Barry Gifford, for instance, who wrote the story that David Lynch made the movie Wild at Heart out of, or Lost. He co-wrote a film with David Lynch called Lost Highway.
Yeah.
Exactly. And there's others. I'm not sure how to pronounce his name. Chuck Palahniuk?
Palahniuk. Yeah.
Palahniuk.
Fight Club.
Yeah. The fellow wrote Fight Club. Or the fellow that just wrote the book that Bringing Out the Dead is based on. He's realizing some pretty substantial financial reward for his writing. Other writers, highly sophisticated writers, will probably never realize a substantial enough amount of money to make a feasible living at it. So it's a funny thing. Why some writing is comes with a very high financial reward, and most writing doesn't. Unfortunately, most writing, if you make more than $500 in a year, you're doing extremely well. Journalism, I suppose, if somebody wanted to write for money, journalism would be a good way to start. But I would not. Passion for writing, unfortunately, does not equate with high financial reward. I'm afraid. I wish it did. That'd be great.
Wouldn't things be better if we recognized people for their gifts and they were doing that? I mean, there seems to be so much money with certain people. Bill Gates owning as much or controlling as much wealth as...
Oh, boy, now you're really going to get me going.
100 million. And just at the very end of the interview, briefly, your thought about that.
Yeah, that is certainly. All through at least the last 300 years of West European history, there's been a tremendous emphasis on technology. Very little thought or very little reward is given to people who endeavor in other fields that are less tangible than technology, and which is shame, because at the same time we have all these magnificent things around us for cooking and driving and getting from one place to another, and now with computers, of course, we have this marvelous instrument for doing all the writing and word processing and editing and everything else, and communication with the internet, and this tremendous resource to information. Nothing else seems to evolve. We still hear reports about road rage, and then there was that incident just the other day where the guy walked into the office and opened fire and killed two people. I mean, there's still a lot of violence. There's still a lot of frightening, ugly, evil things going on in the world that nobody seems to really address. Because one of the things that really worries me is with the deterioration in history, in language, and non-commercial values, i.e. art, when these values begin to deteriorate, we're not that far away from having another Bosnia or Rwanda or some other horrible, horrible thing like that. Because it's language, it's values, the values that we share with one another, our cultural values, these are the things that hold us together as a people.
And we're still in that TV era inability to communicate because we're in that kind of duh zone. You know, we can't express our deeply felt emotions, and so violence does that. It expresses that, and then that's something that needs to be avoided at all costs. We're out of time. John, just a treat to have you on the show. Continued success with your work.
Well, thanks a lot. I really enjoyed being here and doing this.
We'll have to do it again sometime.
Yeah.
John Olson has been our guest, Seattle poet and author of Eggs and Mirrors from Woodworks Press, among other recent releases.